The way I began was always the same. I would lean forward with my hands on my knees and stare at the ice, picking a spot on its surface. Then I would picture myself skating to that spot. I'd see myself making a wide circle that I'd bring in tighter and tighter before turning abruptly and skating out of the circle the other way. Then I would actually go and do it. My blades never made a sound. I couldn't let anyone discover what I was doing, so I learned how to skate soundlessly without the chunk-chunk of steel on ice the other boys made when they played the game. This passage is from Chapter 17 of Richard Wagmese's novel, Indian Horse. The novel was a finalist for Canada Reads in 2013, and it's got some amazing poetry and very moving ideas, and I discuss those in the lecture today. The lecture today is for East and West Learning Connections. The East and West Learning Connections group provides lectures and dialogues on current issues and cultural ideas. For more information and how to attend one of the live Zoom events, please check out their webpage, which is in the description below. Last month, I talked about the role of poetry in memoir and the role of memory in life stories. This week, we're talking about a novel, but there are a lot of things that connect with the memoir and poetry in Mary Carr's work. Like Mary Carr, Wagmese has a really good eye for detail and how it works as metaphor. Wagmese weaves the metaphors together into a story, making for a very memorable and accessible narrative. The story of Indian Horse also feels like memoir to me. And I wondered about you guys as well. Did you see these elements of memoir as you read? Have a look at the cover of the book. There's photographs of boys skating and footprints in the snow. So this makes it feel like the events really took place and these people really existed. Richard Wagmese was a Canadian writer from 1955 to 2017. His early life was really troubled. He was separated from his parents when he was only a toddler. His parents were drunk and left him alone. He almost froze to death, but he was found with his siblings by a policeman near Minaki, north of Kenora. Now, similar experiences described in the book Indian Horse, although the details of it are different. Kenora is a 5-hour drive northwest of Thunder Bay, and Thunder Bay is 15 hours drive north of Toronto. So you can see how far away from Toronto that is. Still, a lot of his experiences speak to us here in Canada, no matter where you live. Wagmese wrote several well-received books, and Indian Horse was a selection for Canada Reads in 2013. It was a best-selling book in Canada in 2018, and it's grown in popularity, maybe partly because it tells an engaging story and because it helps us understand the history of residential school survivors in Canada. In the passage I gave you to read, Saul Indian Horse is a boy at a residential school called St. Jerome's. Now, I was wondering what the audience knows about residential schools. In any case, I think it's important to explain it here a bit, because I've certainly met people, Canadians, who seem not to understand why residential schooling happened or really what it was. Residential schools were a system of government schooling in Canada that was actually common in Canada and the US from the late 19th century to the 1960s. The process went something like this. Government agents would go to remote communities and they would find native children and take them from their families. They said that children were required to be taught how to read and write, but there were no schools in these very small native communities. The communities were very far from cities. They were, some of them, fly-in communities, villages where there are no roads because they're so far away in the north. For small white communities, the government provided teachers and schools, but for small native communities, they did not send teachers to live there. Instead, the government would send agents to the villages and take the children away. Then they would take them to schools hundreds of miles from their home. These were boarding schools. Now I'll show you some pictures of some of these schools. This ruined one is St. Joseph's, and the photo is from an article in the Walrus magazine. The article is called If These Walls Could Talk. It's a great article. You can have a look at it. Now, I have to stress that these comments that I'm making about residential school, This is how I think of residential schools in my mind, and some of these details could be inaccurate. So please do check out media, and especially have a look at the website called Where Are the Children? Healing the Impacts of Residential Schools. Now, this is at the web URL legacyofhope.ca/where-are-the-children, and I'll put that link in the description as well. At these residential schools, students would stay there for months, for the length of the term at least. However, at the end of the term, sometimes there was no easy way of getting home, so sometimes the students would stay over Christmas or the whole year, and at the end of the year there might be no easy way to get home either because it was hundreds of miles away from their home. So the students would stay an extra year or two at the school without having seen their parents. Their parents had no phone and the children could not write and read very well. Sometimes the parents couldn't read or write very well either, so there was no way to communicate with parents. For years, they might not see their parents, and in fact, they might completely lose touch with their parents. So the schools effectively made orphans of the children because the children were without their parents. The schools were run by Roman Catholic priests and nuns who themselves were not parents. And many of the priests and nuns, sadly, abused the children. They abused them by beating them or through sexual abuse. They used the children to do manual labor, like farming, and the children often grew up without a sense of what a family should be. Because of the abuse, they developed post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Later on in their life, they were unable to develop proper relationships with other people and with their own family members. As Wagmi says in his interview with Sheila Rogers on CBC, the adults were unable to nurture their children, so when they had children, the cycle of abuse continued. They also neglected their children because they themselves had become alcoholics in a way to self-medicate and deal with their own PTSD. Richard Wagmi says he himself had PTSD from the abuse in his childhood. In this way, the residential schools became one of the things that broke apart Indigenous families and, as a result, broke apart their culture. Finally, the children were not allowed to speak their own native language in the schools. They were beaten if they spoke their own language. So they lost their language and their families. And all of these things happened to the family of Richard Wagmese, as well as to his character, Saul Indian Horse. Residential school history is not just something that happened in Canada. Similar things happened in the US and Australia. In fact, there was a new article just today, which is May 11th, about American Indigenous residential schools, and the article was on CBC. So these schools were part of an effort to, quote, kill the Indian in the child, end of quote. And this was a common saying in the 19th century by missionaries and priests who thought that their job was to kill the culture of Native people. So, before today's lecture, I circulated a passage for you to read from chapters 17 to 22. This passage is from the middle of the book. However, at the start of the book, we're introduced to the boy, Saul Indian Horse. He is Ojibwe. He's one of three young children, but he does not know his brother and sister because they have already been taken from his family by the government. He lives with his mother and father. However, his mother and father are sad, traumatized people, and it's his grandmother, Naomi, who leads the family. They live near Kenora in the bush in a tent, and they survive by hunting and fishing and gathering wild rice. After his grandmother dies and his parents disappear, Saul Indian Horse is taken to a residential school called St. Jerome's. This is a fictional school, but the description is historically accurate. Chapter 21 describes how the school was, quote, hell on earth. The end of chapter 21 has an ironic reference to, quote, God's love. It's clear that God's love is an ironic statement because there is no love at the school, not from the Christian God or anyone else. There is only abuse. The reference to God's love is linked with the sexual abuse one of the girls suffers, Angelique Lynx. This kind of reference to abuse is typical of how Saul discusses abuse throughout the book. Indian Horse describes not the abuse itself, but the child's confused and fearful reaction to it. As Sheila Rogers says in her interview of Wagmese, the reader has to imagine this abuse. She says to Wagmies in her 2012 interview, quote, "You decided to not put it all in the book." She asks if this was a difficult decision to talk about it in this way, and Wagmies says no, it wasn't difficult because he heard his family speak about abuse in exactly these kinds of ways. They would not describe it in detail directly, they would mention it in passing, and they would mention only a part of it. He says, quote, "I remembered those people the way they told me those stories. They only gave me as much as they could because they couldn't go the whole depth of it. It was left to me to imagine what the whole impact of that was," end quote. And so Wagmies recreates that experience for us. We are left to imagine what actually happened, how it happened. Later on in chapter 21, on page 81, Saul explains more of what he means by hell on earth. He says in the book that this refers to, quote, "how your innocence is stripped from you. You come to see yourself as less than human. That is hell on earth, that sense of unworthiness. That's what they inflicted on us." Wagmies uses metaphor to suggest things that are indescribable. For example, God's love is a painful, ironic metaphor for the abuse that Saul experiences. But metaphor can also be a way to talk about things that are powerful and somehow greater than language. The title of the book is a grand metaphor, too. The book is named after the narrator, Saul Indian Horse. You can see that the main character, Saul, describes his hockey teammates as being like brothers and horses. So being a horse means he is connected with them, similar to them. They are like a herd of horses on the ice, connected with each other and connected to the natural world by the act of skating. In the book, there is a feel of memoir, too. His voice is very authentic in the sense that it sounds like the character is telling us his life story. It's written in the first person, and it also sounds like a real person telling us a real story. And in fact, many of the things he discusses in the novel did happen, although Saul Indian Horse is a made-up character who did not actually exist. The experiences of the kids in the school, these are real. These kinds of things happened to people he knew. These kinds of things commonly happened in residential schools. So poetry is a really important element of the novel too, but politics is an important aspect as well. And when I use the word politics, I use the word in order to describe how groups of people might solve problems together without fighting. I think of law as rules for how we solve problems between individuals without fighting, and I think of politics as how we solve problems between groups of people without fighting. In this way, maybe we can see hockey as a metaphor for politics. Now, this is very arguable, and when I gave the lecture, we had a discussion afterwards, and someone successfully pointed out that hockey is really very peaceful and doesn't have to do with conflict necessarily. But here is what I was thinking about in terms of hockey as politics. Hockey shows us two groups in conflict, but acting out the conflict in a peaceful way, resolving it, and also following rules together, the same rules. Although they are two opposing teams, they're doing the same thing peacefully to resolve their conflict. Although they are two opposing teams, they have one community. They have the same values. They're all brothers. So that's the question. Can hockey be a metaphor for politics? Is hockey peaceful? Is it potentially more violent? Hockey is competitive. Does politics need to be competitive? Politics is exploitative. Can hockey be exploitative? Is politics always a competition? Is there always a winner or a loser in politics? Because there's always a winner or a loser in hockey. This book raises an issue in Canadian politics, though. The experiences that are described by Saul Indian Horse, the experiences of the residential school and the abuse, these connect to a fundamental conflict between Indigenous people and Canadian society more generally. The residential school where Saul Indian Horse learns to skate and where many people are abused, this type of school was a product of racism and also promoted racism towards Indigenous people. And so the book raises the question for us of how we are to deal with the lasting effects of that racism. Later in the book, Saul Indian Horse goes on to play on hockey teams with white players in white towns. his experience of hockey really changes at that time. He plays on a feeder team for the Maple Leafs, and during this time he faces a lot of racist attacks and beatings. These bring out deep anger inside him, anger that comes from the abuse he faced as a child. This kind of racism is another political aspect of the book. So that's a major question, I think. When writing the book, Richard Wagmees is using poetry and narrative to present this political issue. So, what do you make of this idea that poetry and politics are being linked in this way? How can poetry or narrative help us deal with this political problem, this racism? How can poetry or narrative help us to resolve problems of racism? What's the role of poetry in literature when it comes to politics? What's the point of reading poems when there's so much suffering in the world? Politics is a way to prevent suffering, hopefully. So what role does poetry play in that? Another way in which this novel connects to last month's lecture is the link between memoir and fiction. Last month, we talked about how memoir is a kind of life writing which selects part of the life and maybe leaves other parts of the life out. And there are definitely aspects of that in this novel. There are definitely aspects of the novel that are drawn from Richard Wagmees's real life. For example, he did play hockey and he loves it very much. He does see spiritual and healing aspects in hockey. He sees spiritual healing aspects in nature. And he sees how the game of hockey and the act of skating connects us with nature. Skating connects our body, our minds, and the spirit with a natural world. So I'm interested in another question, in whether you think nature is a spiritual thing, because that is something we've touched on before. The love of skating is very real in the author's life. If you listen to the interview with Sheila Rogers on CBC, you can see that. But the specific things that happened to the main character did not actually happen to the author himself. Some of these things happened to people he knew or family that he had. For example, the author, Richard Wagmees, himself did not go to residential school, but his parents did. And many members of his extended family did, and so he was quite familiar with the trauma that they all experienced. They heard the stories. And in fact, he did himself experience trauma due to having alcoholic parents. Richard Wagmees tells Sheila Rogers in the interview that he was not in the residential school system, but he was part of what is called the 60s scoop. What was the 60s scoop? In the 1960s, Indigenous children were taken from their families and put with foster families, white families, who had no knowledge of Indigenous culture. Richard was one of these because his parents were alcoholics and left him and his siblings alone. Once he was put with a foster family, he did not see his own family again for 21 years. So although Wagmees did not experience residential school, he was separated from his family. Because of these terrible abuses, Wagmees ended up reading. In fact, he says he spent a lot of time in libraries as a teen. He was homeless and he went into libraries to be warm and safe. While there, he did a lot of reading. He says he was drawn to the library because his life was filled with violence and noise and the library was quiet and safe. So I wondered, with you, can you relate to this idea of finding safety and refuge in a book? And is safety almost a prerequisite for reading? Now, although Saul Indian Horse does not do a lot of reading in this book, safety and quiet and solitude are really important elements of the imagery of skating. Saul Indian Horse learns how to skate soundlessly. He says, "My blades never made a sound." So the silence of skating is important for him, and he practices alone a lot, and that's how he becomes a fast, talented skater. And he's safe when he's alone, right? Reading and skating are linked in other ways too. In a 2016 interview with Candy Palmater, Wagmees describes reading in libraries as a transformative experience. He says that it's like being touched by language. And he praises, quote, "the magic that happens when you get touched by language. You disappear into somebody else's dream that fills up all of the empty spaces in your chest. and it allows you to be lifted up and transported away from your desk or table and free to wander in a whole different imaginary landscape that is marvelous and entrancing. Richard Bach Mises's words there are poetic. Like reading, skating is a mysterious, transformative experience in the novel Indian Horse. It takes you to a whole new world and makes you feel free. Knowledge of skating is something secret, something that's a mystery. He says, I kept my discoveries to myself. I'd walk through the dim hallways of the school, warmed by my secret. Skating, like reading, is magical and spiritual. The spiritual aspect of skating is highlighted in the first passage that I read and that I gave to you to read in the PDF, just a few pages from the book. The character Saul Indian Horse describes how he teaches himself to skate, and he explains the spirituality in the terms that his grandmother gives him. His grandmother Naomi was not a Christian, keep in mind, but his grandmother is an extremely important figure. She's the only family member who puts up proper resistance to the residential school, and she's the only family member who tries to keep him alive. Interestingly, though his grandmother is not using Christian terms to describe the spiritual importance of mystery, the idea of mystery is certainly something that we see in Christianity. Last year, I gave a lecture on the Book of John, and I talked about how Christianity has a couple of different attitudes to knowledge. On the one hand, knowledge is found in a book by reading, but on the other hand, books can be difficult to understand and mysterious. Therefore, the knowledge of God is seen as a mystery too, because the books that talk about God are hard to read, so the knowledge of God is mysterious and difficult. So in Christianity, believing in God is a kind of mystery, and a mystery is something hidden. So mystery and spirituality are closely linked in ancient Christian culture too. The idea here is that God is hidden and spiritual knowledge is something hidden. Spiritual knowledge is by nature mysterious. Now in Indian Horse, we see ice and skating as a mystery. Specifically, Saul says, quote, when I released myself to the mystery of the ice, I became a different creature. I could slow down time, choose the tempo I needed whenever I launched myself into learning a new skill. End quote. So Saul describes ice as a mystery. Ice is an aspect of the universe, and according to his grandmother, the universe is a mystery. Another idea here is that time itself slows down when Saul is busy skating, and I think this is a really interesting idea about time if we consider how we think about the past and future in our lives. If the past is stressful and unhappy, we try not to dwell on it. If we're feeling anxious about the future, one way for us to distract ourselves is to try not to think about the future and try and ignore it. We don't plan. All these are ways that we can feel like we are stopping time. After all, time is revealed to us by the stories we tell ourselves about the past or our plans for the future. Saul stopping time is perhaps related to the trauma that Saul experienced. Now, when we read the passage that I put in the PDF, when we read that passage, we don't actually learn about the abuse that Saul suffered. We don't find out about that abuse until the very end of the book. And I wonder if this is a way of somehow stopping time, stopping the story that he doesn't want to tell us from the past. Saul postpones telling us about the most horrible things until the end of the book. And in that way, he makes the magical experience of skating last longer. He makes the time of skating seem magical and special, and he doesn't damage this view of the perfect experience of skating. I wonder if trauma survivors do something similar when they try to block out memory. When they block out memory, somehow they're stopping the experience of the past, removing it somehow, kind of changing the passage of time. Of course, that's only one way to interpret the passage. Another way to interpret skating as time slowing down is that we usually think of time as always marching forward. We say, time marches forward, time controls us. But by stopping time, Saul gains control. So time is something that normally limits us because we don't have enough time to do the things we want. It controls us, we only have a short amount of time on Earth to do what we want, and we have to use it in a careful way. Having free time means confronting a set of rules that controls us. So when he says that skating involves slowing down time and Saul is being able to choose his tempo, choose his time, really this seems to suggest that in skating, Saul has the unique ability to be in control. The ability to be in control when he skates is also important because it's clear that he does not have a lot of control in the rest of his life. He's not in control when he lost his family members early on in the book. He's not in control at the residential school. In fact, others are controlling him and abusing him. They are abusing their control of him. Later on, he's not in control of his own personal urges because he is controlled by alcohol and alcoholism. So being in control of his body and his mind on the ice is contrasted. It's a wonderful experience for him. Skating is the way he can experience being in control of his body and his destiny. Skating is the way that he can be free. So there's the experience Saul has when he's alone on the ice. And at that time, he seems connected with the mystery of the universe. Now, I want to talk about love. Because one major difference between this book and Christian belief is the idea of love. In Christianity, God's love is good. In this book, the Christian God's love is bad. It's abusive. The love Saul feels for skating, however, is spiritual. In other words, if there's a God in this book, it's the God that we see in the natural universe, a God we see in ice and skating. In skating, love, brotherhood, and mystery are all connected. The idea of God is connected with love in the book, but it seems that Saul believes in a God that is not exactly the Christian God. He uses the word God in the name God's Lake, for example. God's Lake is a place of refuge in his childhood. It's a place where his grandmother takes him. Now, God's Lake is also a real place outside the book in Manitoba. Toward the end of the book, Saul also has a vision in which he goes back to God's Lake, and this is a very special place of healing and safety. So Saul seems to believe in God, just not the God of St. Jerome and not the God of Father Lebouthier. Saul also believes in love, despite his early experiences of abuse. So love is connected with the healing experience of ice. Indeed, Saul fully experiences life when he is on the ice alone. He says on page 66, quote, "I reached out with all the love in my heart and let it carry me deeper into the mystery," end quote. And in fact, on page 77, the priest tells him, quote, "The game loves you," end quote. The priest also tells him that when he skates, he is beautiful. So, the game loves you, he says, and Saul says he loves the game back. These expressions of love are really important and interesting, considering that in the rest of the book, we don't see any expression of Saul loving anyone. Saul does not have any close relationships to his family members after he leaves the residential school. He has some brotherly relationships with his teammates, but he never has a close, intimate relationship with a woman or a man or any family member. So it's strange to read about love in relation to hockey. If you read the whole book, I think you'll understand by the end that it's very difficult for Saul to feel love because of the abuse he experienced. As for the priest that helps him learn hockey, for the most part of the book, that priest seemed like a good guy. But at the end of the book, we see this was not the case. There are other times on the ice when he is playing the game with other people. If we look at chapter 18, Saul describes the other Indian boys who play hockey, and he uses the phrase, like gathering of brothers, of kin. He describes them in ways that sound like their horses. He says they, quote, "expelled air of mustangs. The clomp of their blades make me think of hoofs on a frozen ground," close quote. A mustang is a wild horse, and the hoofs are those of horses. And at the end of the chapter on page 71, he says, quote, "we stood there like stallions home from the range." So here, Saul seems to have found his people and his place. They feel like stallions. A stallion, of course, is a masculine, powerful image suggesting freedom and dominance. I mentioned earlier that Saul felt in control while he was on the ice, and that was a significant experience because in the rest of his life, he did not feel in control. Similarly, this image of the stallion suggests that on the ice, these boys are in control. And that's in contrast to the rest of their life where they are discriminated against and controlled by other people. Another really important aspect of the horse metaphor is the sense of brotherhood. Saul, Indian Horse, is not alone when he's on the ice. He's with a whole other group of boys just like him, a group of horses, as it were. If we look at the end of chapter 19, we can see how lonely Saul feels because he has never heard from his parents. He wonders why they have not contacted him. It's clear they can read and write because they've already taught him to read and write before he comes to the school. And this is an advantage he has over other boys. But his parents chose not to contact him, and he's hurt by this. Meanwhile, the passage shows us why he needs the brotherhood of the game of hockey so badly. He really has no one left. If you read the beginning of the book, you hear a little bit about Saul's family background. Essentially, his parents are sad and ashamed because they're alcoholics and because all of their children except Saul have been taken away to the residential schools. It's the grandmother that raises him and takes care of him. She tries to raise him in the woods so that he learns how to trap and fish and be self-sufficient. Now, I haven't talked about what happens in the book after the passage, but essentially the rest of the book tells how Saul improves at hockey and becomes a contender for the major leagues. Unfortunately, he fights too much. Because of this, he does not go on to play for a major league team. He's triggered to fight by the racism and attacks he encounters, and his own PTSD generates too much rage in him. He then becomes a traveling working man, doing everything and anything. Finally, his alcoholism lands him in hospital and then in alcohol rehab, and he begins a healing journey. Eventually, he returns to where he has come from, and some hidden memories are revealed to him. He does eventually heal, which is a relief for the reader. I think the book is a gentle way of showing us about the suffering he experiences, but it's not as painful to read as it was to experience. So here are some of the questions that we can talk about in the discussion after the lecture. These are the questions we discussed on May 11th. The main question, of course, is did you enjoy the reading and what you liked about it? The next question is, what did you find surprising or unusual? I also asked in this lecture, what elements of memoir do you see in Indian Horse? And what elements of poetry do you see? I'm also curious as to what you know about residential schools. And the question about hockey and politics, what do you think about that? Is hockey a good metaphor for politics? Or perhaps not, because hockey is a very positive thing in the book. And politics, of course, can be very dire. So the overall question that it leaves me with is, what's the point of reading poetry when there's so much suffering in the world? You know, politics is how we should try to prevent suffering, right? So what role does poetry play in that? Of course, I also am wondering, what's your experience of a natural outdoors activity, and do you find it healing? Is it spiritual? And finally, I wonder if you can relate to this idea of finding safety and refuge in a book. Is safety a prerequisite for reading? So those are some of the questions that I'll leave you with, and I look forward to next month's lecture. The lecture in June, it'll be on the second Wednesday in June, will be about a short piece by Sharon Butala called The Subtlety of Land. So this short essay is found in the anthology called Northern Wild, and I'm going to provide some passages for you to read from that essay, and I look forward to talking about it with you more. Sharon Butala talks about what it's like to be in the countryside outside of towns, and what it's like to learn from nature. So it carries on with some of the themes we've already talked about in Richard Wagmese's Indian Horse. So what's the significance of nature? Is nature somehow a spiritual thing? And what kind of meaning can we get from reading about nature in narrative and essay and poetry? Thanks very much for listening. I want to encourage you all to go to the East and West Learning Connections website and learn more about all the events that they are giving at the moment.